Brown v. Calamos. Mr. Gatto.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, the issue presented by this appeal is whether the state law breach of fiduciary duty claim asserted by the plaintiff with respect to the Calamos Fund constitutes a covered class action under SLUSA that alleges an untrue statement or omission of a material fact in connection with the purchase and sale of a covered security. There's no dispute that this would be a covered class action under SLUSA. There's no dispute that there's a covered security at play under SLUSA. The dispute concerns the middle two elements. The point as to whether there is an allegation of a material misstatement or omission and whether it's in connection with the purchase and sale of a covered security. Your Honors, I think the first point really is the critical one here, and that is that the complaint contains no allegation of an untrue statement or an omission.
Well, it certainly has the allegation. It says the fund's public statements indicated the holders of its common stock could realize, as one of the significant benefits of this investment, leverage that would continue indefinitely. Clause is described above the terms of the AMPS was perpetual. I think your argument is that the question shouldn't be whether there's an allegation in the complaint, but whether the complaint is charging fraud. Isn't that really your argument?
Your Honor, that's correct. There is no allegation of fraudulent conduct or deceit.
Charge, right. You're not trying to get relief from a fraud. But, you know Judge Sutton's Sixth Circuit opinion, which he says, he's very literal about it. Maybe you don't like that, but he says if it's an allegation is an allegation. It's just something said in a complaint. And if it refers to fraud, if it intimates fraud, that's all you need. Isn't that the critical issue, whether he's reading allegation too literally?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we read literally 15 U.S.C. 77P, sub B, the provision of SLUSA, it talks about an allegation of a material, of an untrue statement or omission of a material fact. And I think the word material in that setting must relate to the cause of action that's being brought. Whatever the alleged inaccuracy or misstatement or omission is, it must be material to the claim. That's what the statute says.
No, material to the transaction.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, there's no allegation of an underlying securities transaction that is alleged to have been influenced by the conduct. The conduct here is purely the actions of the trustees in choosing to cause the fund to redeem the preferred stock and to replace it with an alternative
method of
financing.
But would that have been a problem? I mean, would you have had as good a case if they'd never said anything about the perpetual nature of this bond or whatever it is?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Their statements have no bearing on the merits of the case.
Then why are they in your complaint?
Well, Your Honor, in the complaint, the underlying fact that there was no stated term on the preferred stock is an important feature of the financing, and it's explained in the complaint to set forth the reasons that the replacement of that financing with short-term financing was ill-advised. There are other features of the preferred stock that were also favorable, which are also described in the complaint, the cost, the treatment under the Investment Company Act, et cetera. There are other features which are also significant. That's the reason that the complaint in several places references the so-called perpetual nature, the lack of a maturity date, the lack of a stated term, the fact that there would never be a time when the fund would be obligated to redeem those shares.
Right, and the whole theory of fiduciary breach that the complaint advances is related to those representations.
Well, it's not, no, Your Honor, it's not related to the representations. It's related to the underlying fact that the fund had that financing in place and that the trustees elected to replace it with different
financing.
You're
alleging that they were misled.
No, Your Honor, we're not alleging that they were misled. We're alleging that, to go to Judge Posner's question regarding whether the case would be better if or weaker if there had been no statements made, the fact that the defendants in connection with the redemptions in 2008 and 2009 made statements in their SEC filings regarding the perpetual nature of the financing simply has no bearing on the merits of the breach of fiduciary duty claim. The breach of fiduciary duty claim goes to their conduct as trustees in electing to cause the redemption and the replacement with new financing. And that breach of fiduciary duty claim would be the same irrespective of whether they ever made any public statement regarding the term of the auction rate securities.
Could you have said to the district court, I'd like to file an amended complaint. I'm going to delete all this stuff that's suggestive of fraud. Could you have done that?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's quite a bit of case law concerning amending a complaint in response to a SLUSA removal issue.
So this has arisen before?
Yes, and I think the bulk of the case law indicates that plaintiffs should not be permitted to amend in that circumstance. Your Honors, one point I would like to make, because I think this case really is, in many regards, the flip side of the situation this court faced in the Kershaw case, which is cited in the briefs. The Kershaw case involved a situation where a fund did daily pricing on its net asset value, and the plaintiffs alleged that daily pricing exposed the fund to arbitrage loss because of the worldwide markets and the fact that they didn't keep up with the changes in values hour by hour the way that the plaintiffs thought they should. And in that opinion, in Judge Easterbrook's opinion, he specifically notes that the plaintiffs disclaimed any claim of mismanagement of the fund and instead claimed that it was a misrepresentation or concealment case, that the fund had concealed from its shareholders this exposure to arbitrage risk. I think here we have just the opposite situation. We are alleging not a concealment of anything, not a deceit of anything, not a misstatement of anything, instead mismanagement by the trustees in breach of their fiduciary duty owed under Delaware law directly to the shareholders. And in that situation, I think completely consistent with Kershaw, there would be no SLUSA jurisdiction or preemption. Indeed,
That's just a statement of the theory of the claims without regard to the underlying allegations. And the underlying allegations here have to do with the nature of these securities as they were represented to your clients. And that's the gravamen of the factual allegations here, regardless of what the theory of your claim for recovery is.
Your Honor, I would disagree with you insofar as you referenced the as represented to our clients. I think the gravamen of the complaint is that the fund had in place financing that had certain characteristics. Wholly apart.
And that's what they were told when they bought.
Well,
that they were told that these would be perpetual in nature and not redeemed, and in fact they were.
There's no allegation in the complaint, Your Honor, that they were told they would not be redeemed. There's no allegation in the complaint.
But are you saying your case would be totally unaffected if they'd said at the beginning, your shares can be redeemed at any time by a vote of the board or something like that? Would that totally? Because I think one of the concerns is that if this case were allowed to, it went back to the state court, somehow in the litigation it would evolve into a case that included misleading the shareholders by not making clear that it need not be perpetual. It could be perpetual, but it could also last, you know, 2 days.
Your Honor, I think that there's the case would be unaffected if there had been statements that the preferred stock could be redeemed at any point by the board. That would not affect the case because the issue would be, did the board act consistent with its fiduciary duties when it made that decision?
If a case is remanded to state court and fraud crawls into the litigation, does the defendant have a further opportunity to remove?
Your Honor, I believe that the – my time is – may I finish?
No, go ahead.
Your Honor, I believe that the in order for fraud to come into the case, we would have to amend the complaint. And if upon the amendment of the complaint, the defendant would have an opportunity to remove at that point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Legato.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Mr. Bertino?
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is John Rotino, and with the consent of Christian Mixter, who represents certain of the defendants' appellees in this case, I'll be arguing this morning on behalf of all defendants' appellees. As I'm sure the Court knows, this is an appeal in the first of two district court decisions by judges of the Northern District, which have dismissed similar complaints pursuant to SLUSA. I would like to begin at the outset, Your Honors, by addressing the Kircher case that Mr. Gatto made reference to. He is correct that there was a discussion in Kircher concerning the assertion of a mismanagement claim. And specifically, Judge Easterbrook said this, pardon me, counsel for the plaintiffs declined to explain how state law would support a direct action and did not rely on deceit. I'm sorry, that did not rely on deceit or manipulation. A claim based on mismanagement likely would need to be cast as a derivative action. The complaint in this case very clearly is not cast as a derivative action. It is expressly brought as a putative class action, which brings it within the coverage of SLUSA. I would like to address an erroneous assertion that is made at pages 20 and 21 of the plaintiff's reply brief in this case. And that is that there ostensibly are only two statements at issue in this case, which have been attributed to the defendants in the complaint, and the plaintiffs say both of which were issued after the redemption of the ARPs had begun. Those are not the only statements referred to in the complaint that are attributed to the defendants. And although the complaint is careful not to state the date on which these statements allegedly were made, or the documents in which they were made, it is very clear from the allegations of the complaint that the statements necessarily must have been made prior to the time that the AMPs were redeemed. Specifically, the complaint alleges, as Judge Posner has noted, that the fund's public statements indicated that holders of its common stock could realize as one of the significant benefits of this investment leverage that would continue indefinitely because, as described above, the term of the AMPs was perpetual. And then again later, a further allegation that the effect of this leverage was reflected in the fund's regular cash distributions to common shareholders and described in the fund's regular reports to its shareholders. Both of those allegations appear in paragraph 13 of the complaint, which appears at separate appendix 18. The complaint also alleges that they
contained a claim of fraud that was frivolous. Could the district court just say, I'm striking this claim, and having struck it because it was frivolous, now I can remand it? Is that permitted? Or?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. The issue that is presented by a motion to remand of the sort that was asserted here, as well as by the motion to dismiss, which we filed on behalf of the defendants, is a jurisdictional one. And the court was required to address that jurisdictional issue first and foremost before taking any other action. The complaint in this case also alleges, Your Honors, that redemption of the AMPs, and here I'll quote, defeated a significant feature of the investment rationale for the common shareholder. That appears at paragraph 34D of the complaint. And that redemption of the AMPs deprived common shareholders of, quote, the benefits of an investment in the fund as described in the fund's statements to the SEC and to the public, unquote, appearing at paragraph 42 of the complaint. Now, if investors in the fund regarded the continued availability of AMPs financing as a, quote, significant feature of the, quote, investment rationale for investing in the fund, it can only be because they were ostensibly led to believe that the funds, from the fund's public statements, that AMPs leverage would continue indefinitely, as the complaint alleges, because the AMPs were perpetual, as the complaint also alleges. And no investor could have formulated such an investment rationale or come to believe that he or she would indefinitely enjoy the benefits of AMPs financing after the fund had announced that it was going to undertake the redemption of the AMPs. So necessarily, the allegations which the complaint attributes to the defendants must have been made prior to the commencement of the redemption of the AMPs. And similarly, if investors purportedly were led to believe that the AMPS financing would continue indefinitely and on into perpetuity, it could only be because they were not informed that the AMPS would be redeemed at some future date, much less that they supposedly would be redeemed for some improper purpose of the sort that the complaint alleges here. And that amounts to an omission of a material fact within the meaning of SLUSA. And it is the substance of a claim under SLUSA, not the presence of the words untrue statement or misrepresentation or omission, that are relevant. SLUSA cannot be avoided, as the Sixth Circuit stated in the Siegel decision, which is cited throughout the briefs on appeal, cannot be avoided, quote, by editing out the covered words or by using artful pleading concepts that remove the covered words from the complaint but leave in the covered concepts. If a plaintiff could avoid SLUSA simply by the expedient of editing out the covered words or omitting a scienter allegation, for example, then the purpose of SLUSA...
It's kind of a two-edged sword where if we emphasize substance over the verbiage, because if the plaintiffs can't avoid SLUSA by editing out words... should words that have been added by accident and they're not part of the claim, should that necessarily bar remand?
I think that's a very fair question, Judge Posner. I think in every case the court has to look at the complaint and look at the substance of the complaint. How do these allegations fit into the complaint that's been pleaded? And in this case, the plaintiff has actually told us, or at least given us a hint, at why these allegations were included in the complaint. In the plaintiff's reply brief at page 18, the plaintiff has said that the allegations of supposed conflicts were included, quote, to show that defendants had a motive to commit the violations alleged and to, quote, help demonstrate the plausibility of plaintiff's claims. So the idea that these are just gratuitous allegations that were thrown in as some sort of background or is just, by plaintiff's own admission, not credible in this case.
It's my understanding that the factual basis for the fiduciary breach and unjust enrichment claims is in large part premised on the disadvantageous terms of the replacement securities once the AMPs were redeemed in contravention of the representations that they were to be perpetual or indefinite.
That's correct.
And that's the whole...
That's correct, Judge Sykes. The allegation here is that the supposedly less favorable terms of the debt financing that was used to replace the AMPs resulted in a reduction in the value of the common shareholders' shares. So the allegations also go to the share price in this case, which again makes it look, smell, and taste a good deal more like a securities claim than a breach of fiduciary duty claim. That, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out in the Kircher case, would likely have to be brought as a derivative action. On this point of the court's the necessity of the court looking to the substance of a claim as opposed to a search for the literal words of the statute, an illustration of this principle comes from a decision in this circuit in the Kurz case, Kurz versus Fidelity Management, which was a decision of the Southern District of Illinois 2008 that was subsequently affirmed by this court. And in that case, the district court dismissed a claim under SLUSA, even though, as the district court said, the complaint scrupulously avoided any reference to the words untrue statement, misrepresentation, or omission, and even included an express disclaimer of any intention on the part of the plaintiff to assert a claim in fraud. We have a very similar allegation in the complaint in this case, which the plaintiff has, I think, appropriately chosen not to argue on this appeal in light of the case authority on that, on the effectiveness of that sort of disclaimer. The plaintiff in the case has devoted a good deal of attention in briefing to the so-called necessary component test, which is derived from a district court decision of the Southern District of New York in the Expedier versus Credit Suisse case. It's a 2004 case decided a couple of years prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Babbitt, which I think is an important point for a reason I'll describe. And under that test, a claim is precluded under SLUSA only where a complaint asserts an explicit claim of fraud or misrepresentation or, quote, other garden variety state law claims that sound in fraud. Now, if that test applied, we think this complaint, frankly, would meet it. But to apply that test would adopt a rule of law that has no foundation in the language of SLUSA itself and is contrary, I would suggest, to the decision of the Supreme Court in the Davitt case. There is nothing in the language of SLUSA imposing a requirement that a misrepresentation or omission of material fact must be a necessary component of whatever state law claim it is that the plaintiff purports to plead. And the language of the statute is plain and is to the contrary. What's required is that the plaintiff allege an untrue statement or an omission in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. That's it. The question, I think, is, as this court's decision in the Gavin case indicates, whether the injury that is alleged by a plaintiff is one that is proximately caused in connection with the purchase or sale of a security transaction. And that certainly is the case here, where representations supposedly giving rise to the investment rationale for common shareholders necessarily preceded the redemption of the AMPs, and the value of the plaintiff's shares, as I mentioned a few moments ago, is alleged to have declined as a result of that redemption. Secondly, Expedier really proceeds from an erroneous premise. The assumption that the court made in Expedier is that the necessary component test is required to strike a balance, between the way that the plaintiff has chosen to plead his or her claims in a case and the congressional purpose behind the adoption of SLUSA to ensure, to the extent possible, compliance with the requirements of the PSLRA. But I would respectfully suggest, Your Honors, that no judicially created doctrine is necessary to strike that balance. In its decision in the Davitt case, the Supreme Court, and this is a decision that was rendered 2 years after the Expedier case, the Supreme Court observed that Congress had very carefully exempted several categories of cases from SLUSA's coverage, derivative actions, one that I mentioned earlier, a variety of other types of actions that are expressly referenced in the statute and excluded from its coverage. And based upon that, the court said, quote, the existence of these carve-outs both evinces congressional sensitivity to state prerogatives in this field and makes it inappropriate for courts to create additional implied exceptions. And that is precisely what the Expedier test is. It is an additional implied exception that has no foundation in the language of the statute itself. And finally, the Expedier court has not been adopted by any circuit court of appeals. It properly has been rejected, either expressly or in one of its various forms, by several circuit courts of appeals. Those decisions are cited at pages 35 through 38 of our brief on appeal. And most recently, in the September 8, 2011 decision of the Sixth Circuit in the Atkinson case, which was the subject of a letter which we submitted to the court pursuant to Appellate Rule 28J. I'll touch only briefly on SLUSA's in connection with requirement. Plaintiff appears to be arguing in this case that the in connection with requirement isn't met here because the complaint does not allege that members of the putative class, who are defined as owners of common shares, the complaint doesn't allege that any members of the putative class held their shares in reliance upon any of the statements that are attributed to the defendants in the complaint. That argument, as nearly as I can understand it, is based upon a completely unfounded interpretation of the Supreme Court's decision in Davitt. It appears to us that what the plaintiff is doing is reading Davitt to mean that SLUSA applies only to holder class actions as long as the holders are alleged to have held in reliance. And that is simply not what Davitt holds. Davitt holds that SLUSA preclusion can't be avoided by alleging a class limited to holders or owners of securities because the in connection with requirement of SLUSA is coextensive with the meaning of the same language as it appears in Section 10B and Rule 10B-5, and thus applies as long as a deception simply coincides with a securities transaction, whether by the plaintiff or by anyone else. And in this case, necessarily, at least some of the common shareholders who are alleged to be members of the putative class in this case would have traded in these shares and acquired their shares prior to the date of the redemption. I see that my time is up, unless the Court has any questions. Thank you very much, and I would respectfully request that the Court affirm the judgment of the District Court dismissing the complaint in this case pursuant to SLUSA. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Attino. Mr. Gatto?
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points. Mr. Rotuno mentioned and quoted from paragraph 13 of the complaint, which is also a paragraph that the district court cited or quoted from in its decision. And I think the language in paragraph 13 bears some scrutiny here because I think it's quite important. The last sentence of paragraph 13 says, "The fund's public statements indicated that the holders of the common stock could realize, as one of the significant benefits of this investment, leverage that would continue indefinitely because, as described above, the term of the AMPs was perpetual." I think there are two important points in there. One is it says that they could realize. It doesn't say that they were led to believe they would realize. It says that they could realize. And it says indefinitely. It doesn't say permanently. Indefinitely means exactly what it says, without a definite term. That is not the same as to say it will be permanent. And the reason it was indefinite, the term of the AMPs was perpetual. That's not to say that they would be outstanding forever. It is to say that the fund was not under an obligation to redeem those AMPs at any particular time, and that was a significant benefit. That's the leverage and the allegation in the complaint. It is not, I think the district court read that as an allegation that the common stockholders were led to believe that they would get that benefit permanently.
This type of representation is followed by a statement that that there is no certainty that you know these prospectuses, how they're full of these disclaimers, say it's not a certainty, it may not happen, and so on. And because otherwise, someone reading it casually would say, it could realize really big benefits because the leverage, because it's perpetual. That's how people might realize.
Understood, Your Honor, and of course, this is simply a characterization of the statements. This is not purport to be a quote of anything out of a prospectus. Your Honor, another point I wanted to follow up on your question earlier regarding if fraud were to creep in to the case. The paragraph in the complaint disclaiming any fraud allegation, any fraud claim, I think is significant for that reason, because I think it makes it clear that it would be impossible for the plaintiff and improper for the plaintiff to try to bring fraud into the case without amending the complaint. So I think if there were any question as to how that might eventuate, I think it's answered by that disclaimer.
What if discovery produced evidence of fraud?
Well, I think we would have to seek leave to amend the complaint. If it were granted, then the defendants would have an opportunity to remove. Your Honor, one other point, and it goes to the language in Judge Easterbrook's opinion in Kershaw regarding when can – could there be a direct state law claim that did not assert fraud or deceit? And I think there is abundant Delaware law on that issue, that there are circumstances under which a breach of fiduciary duty by corporate directors or, as here, trustees, can give rise to a direct claim without a requirement that there be any fraud or deceit. I cite the court to the Syncor International opinion, 857 Atlantic 2nd, 994.
I thought the point was slightly different, that that the breach of fiduciary duty would be properly the proper target of a derivative suit.
Well, I think the point Judge Easterbrook was making, I think he says in the opinion, would likely be a derivative suit or something like that. And my point is that under Delaware law, there are circumstances under which a direct claim can lie in the absence of deceit or fraud, a direct claim by the corporate shareholders.
And what would those what's the line between
sure.
the direct?
Sure. From the Syncor International case I just cited to the court has a three-pronged test. If the duty is owed to the shareholder directly, if the injury is suffered by fewer than all the shareholders, and if the relief properly belongs to the shareholder as compared to the entity. That's
what was the name of the case? Was Syncor, that in your brief?
It's not in our brief, so you're not. Syncor International, Syncor International, 857 Atlantic 2nd, 994. There's another formulation under Delaware law in a case Thule versus Donaldson, Lufgren, and Jenrette, 845 Atlantic 2nd, 1031. The formulation in that case is whether the shareholder suffers an injury.
845 Atlantic 2nd. What was the page number?
1031.
Okay, so because those cases aren't in your brief, you should submit a letter to the court in which you cite them. You don't have to talk about them, but you cite them. So
okay, and there are a couple of others,
the,
Your Honor. We will submit them all.
That's fine. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Gatto, Mr. Rotino, and thank you both for an excellent oral argument.